Okay, we've got a real treat for you today. The first one up is going to be Hugh. You know, Hugh is from Oklahoma City, my area, and he moved away before we really got to know each other, but then he started Zooming in on my home group every Thursday, so even though Hugh lives in Houston, I get to see him every Thursday. He's a great guy, and he's got a great message, and I can't wait till you guys hear it. So, Hugh, come on up.
Good morning, everybody. Give me a minute, I'm going to set my own timer. So if you hear crickets going off in 30 minutes, that's a reminder to me to wrap it up. All right, so before we get started, I'd like to ask if you guys would take a moment of silence to invite your God, the God of your understanding, into your hearts, and I'll do the same, and then we'll get started. Thank you. Okay, like I said, my name's Hugh, and I'm an addict. And the first thing I want to do is thank my higher power for another day of life, another day clean. I'm grateful to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous today. I want to thank the committee for believing in me and in my recovery and asking me to come share my experience, strength, and hope on the miracle of amends. And I was telling Dee before this workshop last night that I don't think 35 minutes is going to be enough time. You know, I got a lot of miracles that happened in my life as a direct result of living amends, direct amends, and indirect amends. But I'm going to try to summarize all this stuff for you. And the first thing I'm going to do is in the eighth step. I can't talk about the ninth step without talking about the eighth step. So the eighth step, it says, make a list of all persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I have that list. And there's three columns on it. There's one that says, yes, no, not right now. There's a lot of people in the yes column, and there's a few people in the no column, and there's a bunch of people in that not right now column, and eventually they'll move across that page. But so in the eighth step, and it's one of my favorite lines in the basic text, and it certainly is something that brings back a lot of memories for me, because in 2008 I spoke at a convention and at a workshop in Miami. And the topic was forgiveness. And that just happens to be the spiritual principle of the ninth step. But the eighth step leads into it real good for me by saying, at least, as we realize our need to be forgiven, we tend to become more forgiving. At least we know that we are no longer intentionally making life miserable for people. And, you know, that sums up my life during using. Everywhere, everyone, every place I went was chaos and mayhem. And if you were in front of me or you were beside me or you were behind me and you were part of my using and my act of addiction, you were in danger. You know, and I didn't know that until I got here, and looking back on it after working a number of four steps and fifth steps and six and seven, you know, I saw that damage that I had done to the people around me. And I realized at that point, you know, what a turmoil and what a hurricane and a tornado my life had been up until that point. So when I spoke at this convention in 2008, forgiveness was what I was thinking about, you know. And there was a woman in my area in Albuquerque who told my story one time on a CD, and I went home and I was looking at all my literature, and you know, she told what I was feeling at that moment, and I used it, you know. I came from a pretty good family. My parents were divorced when I was young. You know, there was no abuse. There was no alcoholism. There was no drug abuse. There was nothing like that in my family, except my mom and dad fought all the time. You know, so when I got clean and I realized after working the eighth step that I needed to put this list together and make these amends to people, you know, the top two people, number three and four on that list, was mom and dad, you know. And I said, okay, so they're there. And then talking with my sponsor, you know, I said, I don't know if I should put myself on this list. And he goes, didn't you do yourself harm every time you used and every time you did the things you did? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I did. And he said, well, then your name needs to go on that list. And, you know, I had heard people before I worked the eighth and ninth step to say, put your higher power on that list. And I was like, well, God already knows what I did. Yeah, but you know what? He needs to be on that list. He or she needs to be on that list. And I said, okay, you know, because I learned to follow suggestions at that point, and I put God on my list. So I was number one, God was number two, mom and dad were three and four, you know, and then there's a whole litany of other people underneath that, brother, sister, ex-wives, people I came in contact with that I grew up with, stuff like that. But I'm going to talk about the top four people because that's where many, if not most, of the miracles of my life have taken place with regard to amends. So I made my amends to my mom, I don't know, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008. After I moved away from South Florida, I moved back to Gainesville where I used to live. Mom lived in Ocala. You know, we got together on Sundays, went to breakfast, spent the whole day together. And one Sunday we were sitting around after breakfast and I said, Mom, listen, I want to talk to you about something. And she said, what? And I said, listen, you know, for a lot of years, I know that I was tough to deal with. And I said, I was wrong for treating you the way that I treated you. You know, I should never have done that. But I did, and I'm extremely sorry for having done that. And she said, okay, you know, I'm your mother. I forgive you. You know, I love you. That's what I'm supposed to do. And I said, no, Mom, you don't get it. I said, for a lot of years after you and Dad got divorced, I held a resentment against the both of you for doing that because you made me a child of a broken family, and I hated you both for that. And I carried that around with me for 30, 40 some odd years. And she said, look, don't worry about that either because I already knew what your father was doing before you told me. All you did was confirm it. You know, and it was, I felt like this boulder that I'd been carrying around with this chain break away and disappear. You know, so that was the first miracle of the amends for me, you know, was when I did that. When the lightness I felt after having done that was amazing. I didn't realize that, you know, that's what could happen by doing what I had done. And, you know, we had a great relationship after that up until the time she died. And I didn't get an opportunity. You know, we heard Brian talking about it being there for his mom before she died. Well, I was on my way to school one day. My sister called me and said, you know, you need to get home. Mom's back in the hospital. They don't think she's going to make it. And I was driving down 35 to OU. And when I got there, I went to the library, sat down for a minute, and I made my plane reservations home about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By midnight, by the time I got home, my mom had passed. I didn't get to be there to see her before she died. But I was there the next morning because I made those plane reservations. That's what I got to do. I got to be part of her celebration of life. I got to deliver her eulogy. I got to share what she and I had been through and what I had done to correct that. And I had been living a different way of life, you know, for 9 years. So she got to see her son clean. Another miracle of having made that amends. And then you know, after she passed, I moved back to Oklahoma, and a number of years later, I moved away to Illinois, and my dad got sick, and, you know, his wife called me and said, you know, you need to come home. Dad, your dad's in hospice. You know, he's not going to live much longer. And this time, I made those plane reservations right away, and I got there the next day, and I got to see my dad draw his last breath and hold his hand and tell him, it's okay, Dad, you can go. We're okay. And he lived in a coma, and, you know, for another 9 days after that. But I got to be there for him, you know, and I got to do his celebration of life. You know, and that was another miracle of amends. Because I made my direct amends with my father because I hated him for who he had become or who he was. And I became that same man. And that was my biggest fear in life, was becoming exactly like my father. He had a lot of character defects, and I picked up every one of them along the way. So, anyway, every year during my clean time, I would give my mom and my dad a black key tag and a medallion every year. And, you know, my dad got one. He got to see me clean for 15 years, you know, so I'm grateful for that. Both of my parents got to see me clean. I became the son they had always wanted, had always hoped for. You know, and that is a miracle of having made that amends with them. directly, the living amends was not using every single day, calling them every single day and telling them that I love them, you know, and that I'm glad they're a part of my life again. So that takes care of Mom and Dad. Those miracles, those are big, you know, I agree. But there's some bigger ones coming, okay? So I made the amends to my higher power by promising just for today that I was going to live clean. I wasn't going to use today no matter what. And if I felt like using today, I'd tell myself I'd use tomorrow. And I learned a long time ago in recovery that the best thing about tomorrow, you know, it starts today, you know, and tomorrow always becomes today. So if I keep telling myself I'll use tomorrow and I wait until tomorrow, then tomorrow becomes today, I don't have to worry about using. It's kind of a circular thing and kind of a paradox, but when you break it down, you know, I'll use tomorrow. I'll do this tomorrow. Tomorrow never comes because it's always today. I can't step into tomorrow. All I can do is step into today. So I keep that in my pocket, and I use that as a tool, you know, to help remind me what I need to do day in and day out. And my higher power already forgave me for everything I did, everything I'm going to do, everything I think, everything I say. It's already been forgiven. I don't need to worry about it. That's the kind of God I have in my life. You know, I still say thank you every day for keeping me clean, giving me another day of life, providing for my needs, giving me knowledge of, you know, his will for me. I still say that every night before I go to bed. And I can picture God smiling and saying, it's all right, man. I got you. I got you today. You know, you did what you needed to do. You did the best you could trying to stay in my will instead of your own will. It's good. We're good. Okay, so now for the big ones for me, and they involve forgiving myself. Because if I don't do that, I can't forgive you for anything. And I learned that working through the eighth and the ninth steps, you know. Even though forgiveness is about forgiving other people sometimes first, I got to be able to forgive myself for what I might be thinking about you, what I may have done to you, how I may have acted towards you. If I don't do that, I can't forgive you. And I learned that a long time ago, and that was part of my message back in 2008 in the workshop I did then. I need to learn to forgive myself so I can learn to forgive you. Sometimes I have to will myself to forgive you first, you know, and that's a tough job for me to do. Because I hold on to shit a long time because it feels good. It's comfortable, it's familiar, and it keeps me from having to get any damn closer to you and letting you get any closer to me. It's a barrier that disconnects me from my higher power and disconnects me from you. So, all of the miracles that have happened for me personally go way back in my life, early in recovery. Like my first miracle was when I understood that by forgiving myself all the possibilities of this program, all of the things that I'm capable of doing in this program started showing up. Like when I first got clean, I was unemployed. I didn't have a car. I rode a bicycle to meetings, right? I got a little job, just enough money to pay my rent and keep food in my refrigerator, you know, and I moved away with the same company back to Gainesville, and I made a little bit more money, and I got a car. You know, I hadn't had a car in years, you know, because my driver's license was taken away. You know, I got my driver's license back. That's a miracle. You know, I learned how to get registration for my vehicle. I learned how to, you know, pay for the tags that had my name on them, you know. So those are some of the small miracles in my life. But part of the bigger one started when I moved from South Florida back to Gainesville, right, because I had... You know, I had a lot of damage that I had done when I was in Gainesville, because I used in Gainesville. And there was a lot of people there that I didn't necessarily want to seek out, but I knew I had to. My sister's one of them. She still lives in Gainesville. And I found her, and we, you know, I did my amends with her. And it went well for a while, up until my dad died, and, you know, she went off off the chain about something, and, you know, we're not going to get into that here, and I haven't spoken to her since, or she hasn't spoken to me since. My brother lives in North Florida. He stole my identity while I was younger. I had to forgive him for doing that, you know, but we haven't talked since I got clean. Not that I really want to, you know. He hurt me. He hurt me deeply. You know, there's places in Florida, like when he gets in trouble with the law, it shows up on my record, even today, because he used my name. But I'm okay. I forgave him. You know, I don't forget, but I forgave him. And that's what I need to do for me. I need to heal that part of my fractured personality. You know, I'm broken there. I don't know if I can ever put that piece of the puzzle back together, but I'm trying one day at a time. So I spent maybe 18 months in Gainesville, and I got this opportunity. I was applying for jobs with the federal government, like all over the country, you know, because I knew I wanted to do something good with my life at that point. And I'm, you know, almost, I don't know, 47, 48 years old. I want to start a new career with the federal government. And one day, lo and behold, I was on my way to a noon meeting, and I got a phone call from a woman in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and said, hey, would you like to interview for this job? It's a secretary's job. Doesn't pay much. It's only 32 hours a week, but you're qualified for it. In fact, you're overqualified for it. I said, sure. So I sat in the parking lot during the meeting rather than going to the meeting, and I had an interview over the phone with this woman. And like 2 or 3 days later, I got a call back, and they said, hey, you know, we want to offer you this job temporarily, okay? We're going to give you a temporary employment opportunity. Do you want to take it? And I said, yeah. She says, when can you be here? I said, when do you need me there? She said, like 2 days ago. I said, well, it's right around Thanksgiving. I need a couple of weeks to let my current employer know I'm leaving. I need a couple of weeks to wrap up my affairs here. How about day after Thanksgiving? Yeah. She says, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I think I can make that work. And a couple of days later, I realized, you know, I had bitten off more than I can chew. And I said, I called her back and I said, listen, would you mind giving me another 2 weeks before I show up in Albuquerque? Thanksgiving, the travel across the country, the whole... Yeah, sure, no problem. So I wrapped up my affairs in Gainesville, packed up my apartment, my two cats, put my car on a dolly, and drove 1,000, 1,200 miles from Gainesville, Florida, to Albuquerque, New Mexico, not knowing whether or not that job was going to be permanent. Not knowing where I was going to live. I got online, found an apartment, never set foot in it, rented it on the spot. Didn't know anybody in Albuquerque, and one of my friends said, hey, when you get to Albuquerque, call this guy. I met him years ago. He's a great guy. I said, okay. So I got the number. 6 weeks before I got there, I called this dude, and he says, who are you? I said, well, my friend so-and-so met you at your home group, and he said, here's the number, call him, he's a good dude. And he goes, well, who was it? And I told him, he goes, I don't remember who that. I said, well, nevertheless, I'm moving to Albuquerque, you know, and I could sure use somebody that could, you know, get me connected with people in the meetings and whatnot. He said, here, when you get here, call me, I'll take you to my home group, I'll introduce you, blah, blah, blah. Day I arrived in Albuquerque, I called him, I said, I'm here, I'm gonna unpack, I'll see you Friday. He said, all right. Friday night, I show up at his home group. He introduces me to like 50 people. It, you know, it was a huge room. There's like 7,500 people in this meeting every Friday night. It's a closed meeting. 50 people. You know, my head was spinning by the time the meeting started. But I decided then and there that was going to be the group that I was going to go to regularly. I didn't know if it was going to be my home group, but I went to it religiously every Friday night. And he was there every Friday before I got there, setting up the room, making coffee. So I helped. I jumped in and helped him. Another miracle. I didn't know this guy from Adam, you know. And some of you may have seen him in Tulsa 2 years ago. He spoke at the men's wrap. He's a really good friend of mine. He's one of my best friends, sponsor. And, you know, I love this man. My car that I towed from Gainesville to Albuquerque broke down, and I didn't have a vehicle for a couple of days. He gave me his truck and said, use it as long as you need. The only thing is, I got a bunch of crap in the bed before you bring it back. Empty it for me. You got it, man. didn't ask me for a dime for gas, for insurance, nothing. Just keep it as long as you need it. In fact, he was surprised that after a week, I was giving it back to him because I had found another vehicle. Another miracle of having made amends with myself was I was able to ask for help and graciously accept it. Even though I was screaming inside, no, 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 don't do this, you know, you may wreck his truck. He lent it to me anyway. He had faith in me. I ended up doing service with him at the prison in Albuquerque for about 6 months before I left. You know, that was a great commitment to have with him. The very first Tuesday night I was in Albuquerque, he brought me to a prison that where he had an H&I commitment. You know, and these guys were, I mean, these were hardcore criminals, you know, murderers, rapists, all that kind of stuff. And I'm going, dude, I don't have, okay, I just got to wrap it up. I don't have a jail story, right? He goes, don't worry about it. Just come in and tell your story, right? So my story initially involves, you know, getting locked out of my apartment and having this cat that wasn't going to be able to feed herself. And I'm telling this to these prisoners, and, you know, a couple of them came up to me afterwards and they say, hey, man, what happened to the cat? I said, I got the cat. She's at home right now. Oh, good. Cat's safe. I said, well, thanks, man. I appreciate that, you know. So, and, you know, the guys could relate to the using and, you know, the lifestyle and all that, but it didn't matter that I didn't have a jail story. Same thing with the, you know, the H&I commitment at the prison. I don't have a jail story. But the guys in Orange, they didn't care about that. They could relate to the lifestyle, the ripping and the running and the crazy stuff we did. Like part of my normal story is like, I'm a white guy, right? I used to go in the neighborhoods that no white dude should come out of at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning on a bicycle. All right? I ride my bike into the hood just to cop and ride away. I don't know what happened, but I think my dealer told the other homies in there, leave that man alone. He brings me a lot of money every week. Okay? And I'm good with that. So that's one miracle. So there's three more miracles that happened, and I'll try to be quick. I moved from Albuquerque to Oklahoma City for work. I was here for 4.5 years. I met Tim, Dee, a bunch of other people, and they all helped me to grow a little bit more in my recovery. And they taught me how to live a different way of life by watching what they had done, you know, because I can still talk a good game. You know, like I might sound good up here now, but I don't feel good inside. You know, I'm nervous as hell, you know, and this is all strange to me. But the committee believed enough in me and in my recovery to come here and share my experience on the miracle of amends with you. And everything good in my life today, everything good in my life, is a direct result of Narcotics Anonymous, making amends to the people that I love and who love me, making amends to my children indirectly, making amends to people that are no longer on this planet indirectly by living a different way of life today. So I left Oklahoma. I moved to a little town in Illinois, northern Illinois, called Moline, and I was there for 4.5 years. And I got an opportunity for a promotion, and I moved to Houston, Texas. And I had a little difficulty in Texas because, you know, it's Texas, right? And the people in the home group that I was a part of, they're really judgmental, you know, and I found myself slipping back into that way of thinking. And there was some other stuff that happened. And one day in April of 2020, during the height of COVID, I found myself sitting on my patio on a Monday thinking, I'm going to leave NA. Fuck this shit. Right? On Wednesday, the same week, same chair, same patio, find myself sitting down thinking, I'm going to go use. By Friday, sitting in that same chair on that same patio, thinking, I'm going to put a bullet in my head. You know, I can't take what's going on in my home group. They were doing stuff on Facebook that I didn't agree with, and, you know, it was driving me crazy. I was trying to fix, manage, and control all that shit. And one of the things that I had to remember about making amends to myself is, got to let that stuff go. And I realized that at that moment in time, I had to leave that group. You know, I had to protect me from me. Because believe it or not, I'm a firearm owner, and I carry a firearm these days, and I was sitting on that patio with a firearm on my side, and the first thought I had was, get up and put it away. And the second thought I had was, call your sponsor. And I did both of those things, and I sat on my hands until that pain stopped. And I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't remembered what you guys taught me. Like Brian said last night, sometimes you just gotta be still. Sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. And when you feel like doing something, don't do anything. I'm grateful that you guys are here today. Thanks for coming to hear me share. Now, I know my co-speaker, she's going to knock it out of the park. But if nobody's told you they love you today, I love you. And there's not a damn thing any of you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.
Our next speaker is literally one of my most favorite people. I call her a walking NA encyclopedia because if I ever want to know something, I can call Cindy and she can always find it, tell me, and give me page numbers and everything to go with it. So you're really in for a good treat. Here's Cindy B.
I've been called a lot of things. I don't know about it. I love that walking encyclopedia. I don't know if it's true or not, but so I have a lot of tools that I bring with me. Most of them are just like a blanket, you know, like they make me feel safe. They make me feel like I know what the heck I'm talking about because I got all this stuff here. I got my Kleenex that I had to ask for. I usually bring some with me because I know I'm going to cry. I'm going to tell you right now I'm going to cry. You can cry with me if you want. It just comes upon me sometimes, so good or bad. Addict named Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
I will lose time, so
I got it.
Thank you. Is it till 10 or 10:15? Okay. So when Dee asked me to talk about amends and the miracle of amends, to be honest, my first thought was, well, all the miracles that I, not all, but a lot of the miracles related to amends are the ones that I couldn't make, are the ones that didn't go well. And so the miracle on some of those is the growth that I had to go through to be able to get through those times and those situations. And kind of the miracle that got me to the place and did some things happen in my life that prepared me to be ready for those amends that were difficult. So that's a little bit what I'm going to talk about. I got clean in 98. My birthday is getting ready to come up next month. And you know, that always brings on, you know, a little contemplation and, you know, wow, you know, like all the stuff that's happened since then. And before I got clean, my mother had passed away. She was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer in February of 95. She died in September of 97. And then I got clean in May of 98. So a lot of some of the amends that I needed to make are things that happened during that time period when she was ill. And the amends were that kind of weighed heavy on my mind the most were to my mother and to my sister. So, you know, not that I want to go into a big using story about all that, but, you know, I had done some things, and my mother knew she was going to die, and so we went on trips, and, you know, she tried to make the best of it, you know, and had this list, this bucket list that she wanted to have completed, and you know, to get to go do those things with her, you know, is such a gift, but, you know, when you got a plan all around you're using and how you're going to take care of that while you're doing this miracle, you know. and then she, of course, found out, and I would bring stuff with me, and she would find it, and she would just say, I'm not going to give you any more money. And we just didn't talk about it, you know. So I knew, and then, you know, as she got worse, you know, she had a lot of pain medications around, and those seemed to disappear when I needed to get some other kind of drug of choice that I wanted, and she had a really clean house that last 6 months that she never saw because she was in the bed. But, you know, when you're blowing and going, you know, you can't really sit for long periods of time, you know, and and that's what she needed from me. And so after, of course, I didn't have any tools to deal with her death. I didn't have any kind of a spiritual higher power in my life. And after she was gone, I remember for about, you know, I got clean the following May. And then, you know, for almost 2 years after that, it was all I could do to go to her graveside. I would remember, like, driving up to the cemetery and just not being able to go in, you know, because of the shame and the guilt. And so, you know, I had a couple sponsors throughout the years that would, sorry, I gotta breathe. You know, I wrote letters to my mother. I was finally able to go and, you know, go to her graveside and leave flowers, you know, continuously over time. But I never felt like that. That amends was made. And then I got a sponsor. I don't know when I got married. Let's see. It was probably around 2012, maybe, something like that. But I can't remember. We had been traveling together at a zonal meeting up in Nebraska, and when we had went up there, we were doing some workshops on some new literature that was out, and we were this guy kept showing up, thanking everybody because he was getting ready to leave. He had been in Nebraska for a liver transplant. And he had been there for about 6 months, and then his wife was there, and she had come to our workshop to help write some of the, share on some of this literature. And in times of illness, was the literature that was they were working on, and they just kept thanking the NA fellowship there for supporting them through all this long, you know, process that they'd been through with this liver transplant. And then I went to Texas, where my sponsor is, and to do a speak at a camp out down there. And she got really, really ill. And she had just been diagnosed, like, the week after we got back from Nebraska with liver cancer. Ironically, right, after talking to this guy, like, over the weekend so many times. And she got really, really ill, and she was put on a transplant list. And when I went down there that weekend, she couldn't go hear me share. Of course, she was in the bed. I was like, I'm going to go speak. I'll be right back. Finally, the transplant team had told her on Sunday morning, you need to come into the hospital. And I remember she was in so much pain, and I don't know how to drive in traffic. I'm a terrible driver. And she was laying. She couldn't even sit up in the car. She had to lay down. And as we're, like, speeding through downtown Dallas, she's, like, giving me directions from, like, the buildings on the side of the road. on how to get her to the hospital. And we got her in there, and, you know, it just, it was a long process. You know, it was a really long process. And I wouldn't leave. You know, I got to sit with her all day, all night. She kept saying, "You can go, you can go." And I was like, "No, I can't." You know, like, this was my time to get to pay back to my mother the sitting and caring for and doing with, doing for, that I wasn't able to give to my mother. And so that continued to be a process for her, with us over time, to be able to go and help her and stay with her and kind of provide me the opportunity to make amends to my mother through another person, you know. And it's only, you know, my higher power that gives me and that opens those doors and provides me the opportunity to be able to do that. You know, during that time when my mom was ill, my sister was living with her, and when we brought hospice in to take care of her, my sister is 8 years younger than I am. So at the time, she was just 20-something years old, you know, and my mom died when she was 53, so she was really young. And my sister was living there, and, you know, I'm a fix-it person, you know, and I was going to fix this whole thing. And so, you know, when hospice came in, I quit my job. My mom helped pay for daycare for my kids, and I just took over taking care of her, which meant to me cleaning the house, running errands, planting a garden outside that she never got to see. You know, but I mean, I did some things too that were, you know, that helped. But, you know, I kind of took over, and my sister kind of got left to the side. You know, we had counselors come in, and they told, you know, I remember talking to the counselor and being so mad at my sister. Like, she's not doing anything. She's just living her life. Like, everything's just fine. And, you know, the counselor was telling me, like, you know, people deal with things differently. You know, and she's young, and if she doesn't have to see it, then she doesn't have to feel it. And so that's just how she's coping, you know. But, I don't know, you know, I wanted to plan the perfect funeral, and, you know, she was so prepared. She wrote her own obituary. She had us boxing up all of her things for after she died and what was to go where. You know, she was a very organized person, had lots of lists and tabs, and which is, you know, where I get that from. But, you know, Allie just wouldn't get in line with all that, you know, and she moved out, and I felt very abandoned, like, you know, you're leaving me here with, you know, our dying mother and her alcoholic husband, and, you know, but I also like to play the victim, too, so it kind of worked out in my own sick head, and, you know, there's just a lot of things that I pushed her away from, and, didn't give her the opportunity to grieve. And, you know, some of those things you can never make up. You know, some of those things are irreparable. You know, I remember at her funeral, you know, I only asked her to do one thing, and was to get this song ready, and you know, something happened and she didn't do the right song. And I remember, like, getting on to her at the funeral. I'm crying now, not from shame, not from guilt, but just knowing the pain that she went through. So, needless to say, after my mother passed, she didn't really want to have anything to do with me. Imagine. And then I got clean, you know, several months later. And then we really didn't have anything in common. We kind of, my mother was kind of like the glue that kept, you know, that kind of kept us together. And we didn't have a father. We didn't have any other family around. So, you know, it was just us two. And so we really drifted apart. And then plus I was like on a whole nother level and wasn't using with her anymore. And so, you know, we didn't talk for years. And then in about, I was thinking, I was writing down some of these dates, trying to get it all in my head. It was in 2000, here it is. I saw her, so I got clean in 98, my mom died in 97. I saw her once in 2005, and I saw her once in 2007. During this time, she got married, she had three kids, lived in Tulsa mainly, and then we started connecting on social media a little bit, we started texting a little bit, nothing serious, just acknowledgement, and then in, and you know, I had, over the years, when we would try to make contact again, I would say, you know, I really need to talk to you. And her first response every time was, don't even go there. And I really wanted to make amends. You know, by this time I had known the harm that I had caused. Or I thought I did. But, you know, my sponsor kept telling me, like, you can't. Like, this isn't all just about you. You know, you can't, your amends can't cause more harm. You know, if she isn't prepared and ready to accept those amends, you know, part of what you may have to do is live with it. So I, you know, she would say no, and I would say okay. So in August 10th of 2017. So now I've got, you know, 19 years clean. I get an invitation to a tea party that she puts on for her daughter every year. And I completely lost it. I knew right away when I saw the envelope in the mail. Just terrible handwriting. So I knew right away it was her. And she tried to fancy it all up, you know, but I knew immediately who it was. And we were going to a camp out that weekend, but, you know, I was like, I'm going to be back for, you know, we'll be back Saturday night because I'm going to the tea, you know. And it was for her older daughter who I knew. I had met her younger daughter at birth. And then she had a son that I had never met. And so we got to this tea party. And, you know, we hug. She introduces me to my nieces, which is really weird, you know, because, like, this is your family that you're just getting introduced to. And they had, you know, heard about me over the years. And I go to say, hey, afterwards, can we talk? She goes, don't even go there. And I was like, got it. Still. You know, but the part of the thing was is that I thought that I had, you know, there's a piece of in the literature, and it says, I'll find it here in a minute. It talks about the amends that we make, and that it's in Living Clean on page 154. Walking with the knowledge that someone has not forgiven us is hard, but through it we find levels of forgiveness and acceptance that we may not have known possible. It brings us to a clear understanding of what the ninth step is for, and we learn to recognize the difference between hope and expectation. as much as we want someone to forgive us or to own their part of a situation in which was harm and in which harmful was mutual, we have no right and no reason to expect that. Sometimes the path to forgiving ourselves begins with forgiving another for their lack of forgiveness. As we forgive them, we may find compassion for the pain they experience at carrying that resentment and for the pain we have caused them in the first place. And that, you know, that afternoon, and, you know, everybody that knows me knows I'm very OCD, like everybody. My duck's got to be in a row. Your duck's got to be in a row. They got to be color coordinated. You know, I mean. And throughout that day, if something would happen, whether it was the cake or the balloons or whatever it was, she just kept apologizing to me. She kept saying, I'm sorry, I'll do better next time. That's when I really saw the pain, the damage that I had caused. And this is 19 years later, you know. And I had wrote and journaled and did step work on this for a long time, over the years. And then I'm face to face with it. It's undeniable. It wasn't just about what I said to her at the funeral. Or what I didn't allow her to do or be a part of, it was about years of expectations of myself that I put onto her. So after that, we did have some contact for a while. And I'll just, you know, I should have prefaced this of saying that she's still a using addict. And so, and I'm the first one she used with, you know, so yay me. But, you know, there comes a time when, like, I can only be responsible and make amends for the things that I did, you know, and the rest is up to her. But I also have to know that I've been in that place, you know, where it's all everybody else's fault, you know, and it sucks. She ended up losing her children, being homeless, living in a tent somewhere in Tulsa. And I got multiple calls from her husband trying to, you know, get me to help her, and she called at some point and asked me to get her out of jail. And you know, I had gone through some, my son used for a lot of years. I never got him out of jail. I never gave any money for court. I mean, he had plenty of other people in our family that, you know, took care of that for him, but you know, y'all had, you know, kind of helped me through all that and setting those boundaries. But to me, this part of my sister asking for me for help, I didn't really care what it was for. And I didn't care if it was enabling her or not. But, like, it was the only time she had asked me for help in 20 years. So I bailed her out of jail. I don't know if it's the right thing or not. You know, obviously, it... she was grateful. She came to our house, I don't know, I think it was the next year. She came for Thanksgiving and brought her children. And it was messed up. I mean, we were so glad to see the children, but we were so worried about having a using addict at our house. It was clear she was using. We were, you know, it was just, it was a really difficult time. And And then we saw, you know, of course, the pain and trauma that the kids were going through. And so I haven't seen her since then. It's been now, what, how many? 5 years, 6 years? Again, since we've seen each other. I haven't seen her since we moved here. She blocked me on Facebook, changed phones. 2 years ago, I got this random happy birthday text. And I was like, oh, thank you so much. How are you doing? La, la, la. And like, nah, nothing. You know? She texts me on Mother's Day, my birthday, Christmas. I text her. It's all we say. Happy birthday. Love you. I did come across, it was just 2 days ago, I came across her Facebook page that I am now unblocked from. So I could see her. I put a friend request in. I haven't heard back. But, you know, there's hope. You know? And it's not even hope that I get to make amends. It's hope that I get to have a relationship. You know, and I know that it's only through, you know, my higher power and people in these rooms that have shared about amends that have gone and gone well. And but it's one of those things that I don't give up on, because I know that when the time is right, I mean, if I try to make amends and she's not ready, it's not going to go well, you know. I just pray that she, you know, gets what she needs to be able to accept those amends someday. And all I have to do is continue to be willing, you know, and not have expectations on how it's going to go. But it's one of those things that no matter how much pain it causes me, it's, I don't have to use over it, you know? And so that's what prepared me for going through all that and seeing, especially seeing that day and seeing, like, how much pain I had caused her and the real pain that she suffered from. I would not have been able to see that, you know, 10 years before that, you know, because I thought it was all about what happened during my mother's death, not what happened over a lifetime. And just her, me seeing that in her was a big, you know, miracle in my own life of my expectations of perfection of myself and how I put that off on other people, you know, and that's a character defect, you know, that, that I didn't really see, you know, when I have expectations of myself and you don't, automatically that's how I think everybody needs to be. So I know that I fail in that all the time. And so then you're failing me too when I live in that world. You know, that in itself is a miracle that I can see, I can be shown those my character defects through someone else's pain, and that I can recognize that and use that to better myself. So how much time I got? I wanted to talk too about an amends that I thought I was like searching for this amends to make. When I got clean, I had a 4-year-old at home. I had a 12-year-old at home. My 4-year-old, you know, I mean, he remembered some things, you know, but not a whole lot. Me and his dad split up right after I got clean, and we had joint custody, which is a whole nother thing that I could talk about forever. And at 17, when he was a senior in high school, he moved out in the middle of the day and didn't tell us. Like, came home, his stuff was gone. No idea I mean, we were at a ball game 2 days before that, I think. I mean, like, we really had no idea why he left. I mean, he didn't, he was like down the street, right? Because, I mean, I'm in Drumright, small town. I was a nutbag. I'm texting him, calling him. He, like, takes my name off of the school list of that I can call and check on him or get his grades. Like, I mean, it's a jump. I mean, like, it's some serious stuff. And Kobe and I are like, what the hell? And, you know, we're talking to his grandmother, and she's like, I don't know what's going on. He won't tell us anything. I'm, like, searching through my behaviors, things that happen, like, talking to his friends, his coaches, like, what's... And there's nothing. And I would drive around his dad's house, like in the old days, I was driving around, like, obsessed about what's he doing, where he is, you know, like, what's going on. I would go to his ball games, and I was so ashamed that I wasn't, like the other moms. I would sit, like, in my car and watch the ball game. So I didn't want to, like, confront him or embarrass him or... And so, you know, of course, my first thought was, what have I done? You know, it has to be something that I've done. And after a lot of conversations and journaling and, like, honestly looking at my side of the street, I hadn't done anything. There wasn't an amends to make. He's just a jerk. I mean, you know, he, like, believed a lot of bullshit that his father told him. And there's just nothing I can do about it. It's now been, how many years? 7 years? 8 years? I don't even know. I found out last year he had a baby. So that's painful. And it's one of those things that, you know, NA doesn't promise us that we're going to get our children back and we're going to get a job and we're going to get a house. It's just life. I really don't have any control over, you know, other people and what they do. But we still live with the consequences of harm that we cause and the harm that we cause others. And so I've been working with my sponsor on, you know, I have this granddaughter and how to somehow let her know that I think about her often and continue to try to not do anything that I'm going to have to make amends for in the future, right? I mean, Colby went over to his dad's house one time, was ready to break down the door because I asked him to. And, you know, luckily he didn't answer. Ran into his grandmother, his dad's mother, at my oldest son's father's funeral a few weeks ago. And I hadn't seen her in a long time, several years. And, of course, everybody's hugging everybody in a small town. Everybody knows everybody. And I just went up to her and hugged her. I wasn't going to give her any opportunity not to. And she's never really kind of, like, been on my side. She's been on her son's side, you know, so to speak, all this time. And I understand that. And I said, just tell him that I love him. Uh, And she said, I keep trying. And so that gave me hope that at least there was somebody that was trying to let him know that the door was open. Of course, he's blocked me on Facebook too, but then our daughter, she isn't blocked, so she sends me pictures. So, I will end with like a good story. Yay. I'll probably cry for it too, just so you know. So, you know, during, you know, the living amends process, I have this 12-year-old son. His dad and I divorced when he was a year old, and then I married another jerk, and then we lived in him for several years, and then we divorced, and then I met Colby. And so he started using and drinking when he was in high school. He got his first DUI when he was, you know, still in high school. And then he just went through everything under the sun. Didn't finish college. Was homeless, living out of his truck. I don't know. Destroyed four cars. I mean, just, you know, the whole stuff. Tried to get him to a meeting. We thought I would, like, leave pamphlets on his bed and, you know, basic text and, you know, it just doesn't work, you know, it just doesn't work, you know, and it was a long struggle of y'all, you know, y'all helping me through that and figuring out that I was not going to deliver the message to him and it was not my job to, you know, and so part of why I did service for a lot of years was because anything I could do to help keep the doors open so that y'all could deliver the message to him maybe someday. So about, I don't know, 3 years ago, he met this woman who had three kids, and I was like, oh. She has been a miracle in his life. She's an RN. He, like, I think he smokes pot, but to be honest, like, hallelujah, that's all he's doing. You know, it's better than 150 milligrams of oxy a day, you know, and he has a job. They bought a home. He has, you know, vehicles that are licensed and legal and, like, lives, like, a normal life. And, you know, that's something I did. You know, I think that part of the living amends was being in a relationship where he learned how to treat women. And, you know, Colby has taught him that. And so he treats his wife beautifully. They have a great relationship that we can see. He loves those children. He's always loved children. And whether he got them as babies or not, like, he learned from Colby how to be a stepdad. You know, like, and so his dad died unexpectedly. December 26th, they found him. And, of course, we came and were there immediately. And then at the funeral the next week, you know, we're in Drumright. And, you know, a lot of people I went to high school with, just a lot of people had known his story over the years, you know. And he had planned the whole funeral. He was taking care of everything. I mean, like, he was a man. And other people saw that, you know, like, people saw, they came up to me and they said, oh my gosh, Ryan looks so good. Like, aren't you so proud? And, you know, I am. And, while sometimes I wish we had a better relationship than what we do, you know, some of that is on me, not on him. And, but, you know, being able to see, like, the consequences of the living amends and, like, how his life changed and how, like, me getting better provided him an opportunity to see how relationships should be and how life could be. And while that, you know, it's those living amends just kind of seem like there's not a beginning and an end to them, you know? Like, okay, it's just ongoing all the time because you're just always trying to, you know, make sure to cause, you know, cause no harm, you know, anymore. And, but this kind of event kind of showed, it was kind of like, oh, here's the repercussions and here's the consequences and, you know, here's the ending to the story. So it's not really, but, you know, it was like, I don't know, just, I was able to see it. And then his uncle, who is another really important person in his life, the only other man in his life, of any significance, died 2 weeks later. And so then he was able to help his aunt through all that and help plan that funeral and do all that stuff. And so 2 weeks later, we're in the same church, you know, with the same people, like going, what the hell? You know, but to see him do it again for somebody else, you know, was huge. So, you know, those amends, all I'll say is, you know, like when I think of the spiritual principles that come with amends, you know, I think of patience. In my case, like there's been a lot of patience on how long it's taken for to be able to have the opportunity to start making some of these amends. The freedom that comes, you know, freedom from things is not always, you know, yay, freedom. You know, it's sometimes it's painful to see some of the freedoms that you get when you can see reality. You know, like that's a freedom in itself, even if it's painful sometimes. You know, forgiveness, of course, you know, forgiveness for to myself for causing pain and still being willing to change and be able to see it, and forgiveness for others when they're not willing to take a look. And then just the empathy for others too, when I know why they can't look because it's too painful for them because they don't have the tools yet. So thanks for letting me share. Sorry to be such a crybaby.